The single sound floated down the dead cell block and then rushed back. Lloyd shrieked, stumbled over his own feet, fell down, and began to cry.
"That's all right," Flagg soothed. "Hey, man, that's all right. Everything's purely all right."
Lloyd sobbed.
"Can you let me out? Please let me out. I don't want to be like my rabbit. I don't want to end up like that. It's not fair. If it wasn't for Polk, I never would have got into anything but small shit. Please let me out, mister. I'll do anything."
"You poor guy. You look like an advertisement for a summer vacation at Dachau."
Despite the sympathy in Flagg's voice, Lloyd could not bring himself to raise his eyes beyond the knees of the newcomer's jeans. If he looked into that face again, it would kill him. It was the face of a devil.
"Please," Lloyd mumbled. "Please let me out. I'm starving."
"How long you been shit-canned, my friend?"
"I don't know," Lloyd said, wiping his eyes with thin fingers. "A long time."
"How come you're not dead already?"
"I knew what was coming,"
Lloyd told the blue-jeaned legs as he drew the last tattered shreds of his cunning around him.
"I saved up my food, that's what."
"How about Br'er Rat? How did he taste?" Lloyd put his hands over his face.
"What's your name?"
Lloyd tried to say, but all that came out was a moan.
"What's your name, soldier?"
"Lord Henried."
He tried to think what to say next, but his mind was a jumble. He had been afraid when his lawyer told him he might go to the electric chair, but not this afraid. He had never been this afraid in his entire life.
"It was all Polk's idea," he screamed. "Polk should be here, not me."
"Look at me, Lloyd."
"No,"
Lloyd whispered. His eyes rolled wildly. "Why not?"
"Because..."
"Go on."
"Because I don't think you're real," Lloyd whispered. "And if you are real, mister, if you're real, you're the devil."
"Look at me, Lloyd." Helplessly, Lloyd turned his eyes up to that dark, grinning face that hung behind an intersection of bars. The right hand held something up beside the right eye. Looking at it made Lloyd feel cold and hot all over. It looked like a black stone, so dark it seemed almost resinous and pitchy. There was a red flaw in the center of it, and to Lloyd it looked like a terrible eye, bloody and half-open, peering at him. Then Flagg turned it slightly between his fingers, and the red flaw in the dark stone looked like a key. Flagg turned it back and forth between his fingers. Now it was the eye, now it was the key. The eye, the key. He sang, "She brought me coffee, she brought me tea, she brought me damn near everything but the workhouse key." Right, Lloyd?
"Sure,"
Lloyd said huskily. His eyes never left the small dark stone. Flagg began to walk it from one finger to the next like a magician doing a trick.
"Now you're a man who must appreciate the value of a good key," the man said.
The dark stone disappeared in his clenched fist and suddenly reappeared in his other hand, where it began to finger walk again.
"I'm sure you are. Because what a key is for is opening doors. Is there anything more important in life than opening doors, Lloyd?"
"Mister, I'm awful hungry."
"Sure you are," the man said.
An expression of concern spread over his face, an expression so magnified that it became grotesque.
"Jesus Christ, a rat isn't anything to eat. Why, do you know what I had for lunch? I had a nice, rare roast beef sandwich on Vienna bread with a few onions and a lot of Goulden spicy brown. Sound good?"
Lloyd nodded his head, tears oozing slowly out of his overbright eyes.
"Had some home fries and chocolate milk to go with it, and then for dessert... Holy crow, I'm torturing you, ain't I? Someone ought to take a horsewhip to me, that's what they ought to do. I'm sorry. I'll let you ride out, and then we'll go get something to eat, okay?"
Lloyd was too stunned to even nod. He had decided that the man with the key was indeed a devil, or even more likely a mirage,
and the mirage would stand outside his cell until Lloyd finally dropped dead, talking happily about God and Jesus and Goulden spicy brown mustard as he made the strange black stone appear and disappear. But now the compassion on the man's face seemed real enough, and he sounded genuinely disgusted with himself. The black stone disappeared into his clenched fist again, and when the fist opened, Lloyd's wondering eyes beheld a flat silver key with an ornate grip lying on the stranger's palm.
"My dear God!" Lloyd croaked.
"You like that?" the dark man asked, pleased. "I learned that trick from a massage parlor, honey, in Secaucus, New Jersey, Lloyd. Secaucus, home of the world's greatest pig farms." He bent and seated the key in the lock of Lloyd's cell. And that was strange, because as well as his memory served him, which right now was not very well, these cells had no keyways, because they were all opened and shut electronically. But he had no doubt that the silver key would work. Just as it rattled home, Flagg stopped and looked at Lloyd, grinning slyly, and Lloyd felt despair wash over him again. It was all just a trick. "Did I introduce myself? The name is Flagg, with the double G. Pleased to meet you."
"Likewise," Lloyd croaked.
"And I think, before I open this cell and we go get some dinner, we ought to have a little understanding, Lloyd."
"Sure thing,"
Lloyd croaked, and began to cry again. "I'm going to make you my right-hand man, Lloyd. Going to put you right up there with St. Peter. When I open this door, I'm going to slip the keys to the kingdom right into your hand. That's not such a bad deal, is it?"
"No,"
Lloyd whispered, growing frightened again. It was almost full dark now. Flagg was little more than a dark shape, but his eyes were still perfectly visible. They seemed to glow in the dark like the eyes of a lynx, one to the left of the bar that ended in the lockbox, one to the right. Lloyd felt terror, but something else as well. A kind of religious ecstasy, a pleasure, the pleasure of being chosen, the feeling that he had somehow won through to something. "You'd like to get even with the people who left you here, isn't that right?"
"Boy, that sure is," Lloyd said,
forgetting his terror momentarily. It was swallowed by a starving, sinewy anger. "Not just those people, but everyone who would do a thing like that," Flagg suggested. "It's a type of person, isn't it? To a certain type of person, a man like you is nothing but garbage, because they are high up. They don't think a person like you has a right to live."
"That's just right," Lloyd said.
His great hunger had suddenly been changed into a different kind of hunger. It had changed just as surely as the black stone had changed into the silver key. This man had expressed all the complex things he had felt in just a handful of sentences. "You know what the Bible says about people like that?" Flagg asked quietly. "It says the exalted shall be abased, and the mighty shall be brought low, and the stiff-necked shall be broken. And you know what it says about people like you, Lloyd? It says, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. And it says, blessed are the poor in spirit, for they shall see God." Lloyd was nodding, nodding and crying. Yes, this man understood. "Now, you aren't very bright," Flagg said. "But I have the feeling you might be very loyal. You and I, Lloyd, we're going to go far. It's a good time for people like us. Everything is starting up for us. All I need is your word."
Word?
"That we're going to stick together, you and me. No denials, no falling asleep on guard duty. There will be others very soon. They're on their way west already. But for now, there's just us. I'll give you the key, if you'll give me your promise."
"I promise," Lloyd said.
And the words seemed to hang in the air, vibrating strangely. He listened to that vibration, his head cocked to one side, and he could almost see those two words glowing as darkly as the aurora borealis reflected in a dead man's eye. Then he forgot about them as the tumblers made their half turns inside the lockbox. The next moment, the lockbox fell at Flagg's feet, tendrils of smoke seeping from it. You're free, Lloyd. Come on out. Unbelieving, Lloyd touched the bars hesitantly, as if they might burn him. And indeed, they did seem warm. But when he pushed, the door slid back easily and soundlessly. He stared at his savior, those burning eyes. Something was placed in his hand. The key. It's yours now, Lloyd.
Mine?
Flagg grabbed Lloyd's fingers and closed them around it, and Lloyd felt it move in his hand, felt it change. He uttered a hoarse cry, and his fingers sprang open. The key was gone, and in its place was the black stone with the red floor. He held it up, wondering, and turned it this way and that. Now the red floor looked like a key, now like a skull, now like a bloody, half-closed eye again.
Mine,
Lloyd answered himself. This time he closed his hand with no help, holding the stone savagely tight. Shall we get some dinner? Flagg asked. We've got a lot of driving to do tonight.
Dinner, Lloyd said. All right.
There's such a lot to do, Flagg said happily, and we're going to move very fast. They walked toward the stairs together, past the dead men in their cells. When Lloyd stumbled in weakness, Flagg seized his arm above the elbow and bore him up. Lloyd turned and looked into that grinning face with something more than gratitude. He looked at Flagg with something like love. Chapter 31 Nick Andros lay sleeping, but not quiet, on the bunk in Sheriff Baker's office. He was naked except for his shorts, and his body was lightly oiled with sweat. His last thought before sleep had taken him the night before was that he would be dead by morning. The dark man that had constantly haunted his feverish dreams would somehow break through that last thin barrier of sleep and take him away. Coming back from burying Jane Baker, he had swerved to avoid the corpse of a dog lying in the road and had fallen off the bike he was riding. He had gone sprawling, striking his head on the pavement and blacking out. He had come to a long time later, maybe as much as 3 hours by the way the sun had westered, and his vision had been doubled. He had been terrified that he had given himself a serious concussion, perhaps even a fracture. It would have been terribly ironic to have survived the beating administered by Ray Booth and his friends, then the superflu, only to die as a result of falling off a kid's bike. But by dark his vision had begun to come together again, and by yesterday morning it had been fine. It was the slight and unimportant ladder of scratches on his leg that was going to kill him. He had gone without disinfecting it, and by noon 2 days ago the skin around the scrape had gotten red, and all the muscles of his leg seemed to ache. He had limped down to Dr. Soames's office and had gone through his drug closet that night, looking for penicillin or ampicillin. By then he had been feverish and badly frightened. He was well aware that he would die if his body reacted strongly against the penicillin, but he thought the alternative might be an even nastier death. The infection was racing, racing. He found Soames's penicillin samples and swallowed two of the pills. It did not kill him, but there was no noticeable improvement either. His sleep these last 2 nights had not seemed like sleep at all. His dreams were a flood. It seemed that everyone he had ever known was coming back for a curtain call. Rudy Sparkman pointing at the white sheet of paper. You are this blank page. His mother, tapping lines and circles she had helped him make on another white page, marring its purity.
It says, Nick Andros, honey, that's you.
Jane Baker, her face turned aside on the pillow, saying,
Johnny, my poor Johnny.
Unlike all the other dreams he had had in his life, Nick did not have to lip-read these. He could actually hear what people were saying. The dreams were incredibly vivid. Then they would fade as the pain in his leg brought him close to waking. Then a new scene would appear as he sank down into sleep again. There were people he had never seen in two of the dreams, and these were the dreams he remembered the most clearly when he woke up. He was on a high place. The land was spread out below him like a relief map. It was desert land, and the stars above had the mad clarity of altitude. There was a man beside him. No, not a man, but the shape of a man. As if the figure had been cut from the fabric of reality, and what really stood beside him was a negative man. A black hole in the shape of a man. And the voice of this shape whispered, Everything you see will be yours. if you fall down on your knees and worship me." Nick shook his head, wanting to step away from that awful drop, afraid the shape would stretch out its black arms and push him over the edge. "Why don't you speak? Why do you just shake your head?" In the dream, Nick made the gesture he had made so many times in the waking world, a laying of his finger over his lips, then the flat of his hand against his throat. And then he heard himself say in a perfectly clear, rather beautiful voice, "I can't talk. I am mute." "But you can. If you want to, you can." Nick reached out to touch the shape then, his fear momentarily swept away in a flood of amazement and burning joy. But as his hand neared that figure's shoulder, it turned ice cold, so cold it seemed that he had burned it. He jerked it away with ice crystals forming on the knuckles, and it came to him. He could hear the dark shape's voice, the far-off cry of a hunting nightbird, the endless whine of the wind. He was struck mute all over again by the wonder of it. There was a dimension to the world he had never missed because he had never experienced it, and now it had fallen into place. He was hearing sounds. He seemed to know what each was without being told. They were pretty. Pretty sounds. He ran his fingers back and forth across his shirt and marveled at the swift whisper of his nails on the cotton. Then the dark man was turning toward him, and Nick was terribly afraid. This creature, whatever it was, performed no free miracles. "If you fall down on your knees and worship me." And Nick put his hands over his face because he wanted all the things the black man shape had shown him from this high desert place: cities, women, treasure, power. But most of all, he wanted to hear the entrancing sound his fingers made on his shirt, the tick of a clock in an empty house after midnight, and the secret sound of rain. But the word he said was no, and then that freezing cold was on him again, and he had been pushed. He was falling, end over end, screaming soundlessly as he tumbled through these cloudy depths, tumbled into the smell of corn? Yes, corn. That was the other dream. They blended together like this, with hardly a seam to show the difference. He was in the corn, the green corn, and the smell was summer earth and cow manure and growing things. He got to his feet and began to walk up the row he had found himself in, stopping momentarily as he realized he could hear the soft wicker of the wind flowing between the July corn's green, sword-like blades. And something else. Music. Some sort of music. And in the dream, he thought, so that's what they mean. It was coming from straight ahead, and he walked toward it, wanting to see if this particular succession of pretty sounds came from what was called piano, or horn, or cello, or what. The hot smell of summer in his nostrils, the overarching blue sky above, that lovely sound. In this dream, Nick had never been happier, and as he neared the source, a voice joined the music, an old voice like dark leather, slurring the words a little as if the song was a stew, often reheated, that never lost its old savor. Mesmerized, Nick walked toward it. "I come to the garden alone, while the dew is still on the roses. The voice I hear, falling on my ear, the Son of God discloses. And he walks with me and he talks with me, tells me I am his own. And the joy we share as we tarry there, none other has ever known." As the verse ended, Nick pushed through to the head of the row, and there in the clearing was a shack, not much more than a shanty, with a rusty trash barrel to the left and an old tire swing to the right. It hung from an apple tree that was gnarled but still green with lovely life. A porch slanted out from the house, a splintery old thing held up with old oil-clotted jack-lifters. The windows were open, and the kind summer breeze blew ragged white curtains in and out of them. From the roof, a peaked chimney of galvanized tin, dented and smoky, jutted at its own old, odd angle. This house sat in its clearing, and the corn stretched away in all four directions as far as the eye could see. It was broken only on the north by a dirt road that dwindled away to a point on the flat horizon. It was always then that Nick knew where he was. Polk County, Nebraska, west of Omaha, and a little north of Osceola. Far up that dirt road was U.S. 30, and Columbus sitting on the north bank of the Platte. Sitting on the porch was the oldest woman in America, a black woman with fluffy white thin hair. She is thin herself, wearing a house dress and specs. She looks thin enough for a high afternoon wind to just blow her away, tumble her into the high blue sky, and carry her perhaps all the way to Julesburg, Colorado. And the instrument she is playing, perhaps that's what's holding her down, keeping her on the earth, is a guitar. It sounds nice. He feels he could just stand where he is for the rest of the day, watching the old black woman sitting on her porch held up by jack lifters in the middle of all this Nebraska corn. Stand here west of Omaha and a little north of Osceola in the county of Polk, listening. Her face is seamed with a million wrinkles, like the map of a state where the geography hasn't settled down. Rivers and canyons along her brown leather cheeks, ridges below the knob of her chin, the sinuous raised drumlin of bone at the base of her forehead, the caves of her eyes. She has begun to sing again, accompanying herself on the old guitar. Jesus, won't you come by year? Oh, Jesus, won't you come by year? Jesus, won't you come by here? 'Cause now is the needy time. Oh, now is the needy time. Now is the... Say, boy, who nailed you to that spot? She puts the guitar across her lap like a baby and gestures him forward. Nick comes. He says he just wanted to listen to her sing. The singing was beautiful. Well, singing's God's foolishness. I do it most of the day now. How are you making out with that black man? He scares me. I'm afraid. Boy, you got to be afraid. Even a tree at dusk, if you see it in the right way, you got to be afraid. We're all mortal, praise God. But how do I tell him no? How do you breathe? How do you dream? No one knows. But you come see me, anytime. Mother Abigail is what they call me. I'm the oldest woman in these parts, I guess, and I still make my own biscuit. You come see me any time, boy, and bring your friends. But how do I get out of this? God bless you, boy, no one ever does. You just look up to the best and come see Mother Abigail any time you take a mind to. I'll be right here, I guess. Don't move around much anymore. So you come see me. I'll be right here, right here. He came awake bit by bit until Nebraska was gone, and the smell of the corn, and Mother Abigail's seamed dark face. The real world filtered in, not so much replacing that dream world as overlaying it until it was out of sight. He was in Shoyo, Arkansas. His name was Nick Andros. He had never spoken nor heard the sound of a guitar, but he was still alive. He sat up on the cot, swung his legs over, and looked at the scrape. The swelling had gone down some. The ache was only a throb. I'm healing, he thought with great relief. I think I'm going to be okay. He got up from the cot and limped over to the window in his shorts. The leg was stiff, but it was the kind of stiffness you know will work out with a little exercise. He looked out at the silent town, not Shoyo anymore, but the corpse of Shoyo, and knew he would have to leave today. He wouldn't be able to get far, but he would make a start. Where to go? Well, he supposed he knew that. Dreams were just dreams. But for a start, he supposed he could go northwest, toward Nebraska. Nick pedaled out of town at about 1:15 in the afternoon of July 3rd. He packed a knapsack in the morning, putting in some more of the penicillin pills in case he needed them, and some canned goods. He went heavy on the Campbell's tomato soup and the Chef Boyardee ravioli, two of his favorites. He put in several boxes of bullets for the pistol and took a canteen. He walked up the street, looking in garages until he found what he wanted, a 10-speed bike that was just about right for his height. He pedaled carefully down Main Street in a low gear, his hurt leg slowly warming to the work. He was moving west and his shadow followed him, riding its own black bike. He went past the gracious, cool-looking houses on the outskirts of town, standing in the shade with their curtains drawn for all time. On the outskirts of town, he saw a pair of taillights sticking up out of the ditch and dismounted the bike to take a look. It was Dr. Soames's car. Soames was lying over the steering wheel with his eyes closed.
On the floor beside him was his black bag, overturned, its bottles and vials spilling out. Nick looked for a long time and then rode on. He camped that night in a farmhouse 10 miles west of Shoyo. By nightfall on July 4th, he was nearly to Oklahoma. That evening, before he went to sleep, he stood in another farmyard, his face turned up to the sky, watching a meteor shower scratch the night with cold white fire. He thought he had never seen anything so beautiful. Whatever lay ahead, he was glad to be alive. Chapter 32. Larry woke up at 8:30 to sunlight and the sound of birds. They both freaked him out. Every morning since they had left New York City, sunlight and the sound of birds. And as an extra added attraction, a bonus-free gift, if you like, the air smelled clean and fresh. Even Rita had noticed it. He kept thinking, well, that's as good as it's going to get. But it kept getting better. It got better until you wondered what they had been doing to the planet. And it made you wonder if this was the way the air had always smelled in places like upstate Minnesota and in Oregon and on the western slope of the Rockies. And this morning, in Bennington, Vermont, now headed due east along Highway 9, this morning was something special. It was the by God 4th of July, Independence Day. He sat up in the sleeping bag and looked over at Rita, but she was still out like a light, nothing showing but the lines of her body under the bag's quilted fabric and the fluff of her hair. Well, he would wake her up in style this morning. Larry unzipped his side of the bag and got out, buck naked. For a moment, his flesh marbled into goosebumps, and then the air felt naturally warm, probably 70 already. It was going to be another peach of a day. He crawled out of the little two-man tent and stood up. Parked beside the tent was a 1200cc Harley cycle, black and chrome. Like the sleeping bag and the tent, it had been acquired in Passaic. By that time, they had already gone through 3 cars, 2 blocked by terrible traffic jams, the 3rd stuck in the mud outside of Nutley when he had tried to swing around a 2-truck smash-up. The bike was the answer. It could be trundled around accidents, pulling itself along in low gear. When the traffic was seriously piled up, it could be ridden along the breakdown lane or the sidewalk, if there was one. Rita didn't like it. Riding pillion made her nervous, and she clung to Larry desperately. But she had agreed it was the only practical solution. Mankind's final traffic jam had been at Dilly. And since they had left Passaic and gotten into the country, they had made great time. By the evening of July 2nd, they had recrossed into New York State and had pitched their tent on the outskirts of Quarryville, with the hazed and mystic Catskills to the west. They turned east on the afternoon of the 3rd, crossing into Vermont just as dusk fell, and here they were in Bennington. They had camped on a rise outside of town, and now, as Larry stood naked beside the cycle, urinating, he could look down and marvel at the picture postcard New England town below him. 2 clean white churches, their steeples rising as if to poke through the blue morning sky. A private school, gray fieldstone buildings shackled with ivy. A mill. A couple of red brick school buildings. Plenty of trees dressed in summer green gowns. The only thing that made the picture subtly wrong was the lack of smoke from the mill and the number of twinkling toy cars parked at weird angles on the main street, which was also the highway they were following. But it's the 4th, he thought. The mill would have been shut down anyway. He cleared his throat, spat, and hummed a little to find his pitch. He drew breath, very much aware of the light morning breeze on his naked chest and buttocks, and burst into song. Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming? He sang it all the way through, facing Bennington, doing a little burlesque bump and grind at the end, because by now Rita would be standing at the flap of the tent, smiling at him. He finished with a snappy salute at the building he thought might be the Bennington Courthouse, then turned around, thinking the best way to start another year of independence in the good old U.S. of A. would be with a good old all-American fuck. Larry Underwood, boy patriot, wishes you a very good... But the tent flap was still closed, and he felt a momentary irritation with her.
He squashed it resolutely. She couldn't be on his wavelength all the time, that's all. When you could recognize that and deal with it, you were on your way to an adult relationship. He had been trying very hard with Rita since that harrowing experience in the tunnel, and he thought he'd been doing pretty well. You had to put yourself in her place, that was a thing. You had to recognize she was a lot older. She'd been used to having things a certain way for most of her life. It was natural for her to have a harder job adapting to a world that had turned itself upside down. The pills, for instance. He hadn't been overjoyed to discover that she had brought her whole fucking pharmacy along with her in a jelly jar. Yellow jackets, Quaaludes, Darvon, and some other stuff that she called my little pick-me-ups. The little pick-me-ups were reds. Three of those with a shot of tequila and you'd jitter and jive all the livelong day. He didn't like it because too many ups and downs and all-arounds added up to one mean monkey on your back, a monkey roughly the size of King Kong. And he didn't like it because when he got right down to where the cheese binds, it was a kind of slap in the face at him, wasn't it? What did she have to be nervous about? Why should she have trouble dropping off at night? He sure as hell didn't. He went back to the tent, then hesitated for a moment. Maybe he ought to let her sleep. Maybe she was worn out, but... He looked down at old Sparky, and old Sparky didn't really want to let her sleep. Singing the old star-speckled banana had turned him right on. So? Rita? And it hit him right away after the fresh morning cleanness of the air outside. He must have been mostly asleep before to have missed it. The smell was not overpoweringly strong because the tent was fairly well ventilated, but it was strong enough. The sweet-sour smell of vomit and sickness. Rita? He felt mounting alarm at the still way she was lying, just that dry fluff of hair sticking out of the sleeping bag. He crawled toward her on his hands and knees, the smell of vomit stronger now, making his stomach knot. Rita, you all right? Wake up, Rita! No movement. So he rolled her over, and the sleeping bag was halfway unzipped as if she'd tried to struggle out of it in the night, maybe realizing what was happening to her, struggling and failing, and he all the time sleeping peacefully beside her, old Mr. Rocky Mountain High himself. He rolled her over, and one of her pill bottles fell out of her hand, and her eyes were cloudy, dull marbles behind half-closed lids, and her mouth was filled with the green puke she had strangled on. He stared into her dead face for what seemed a very long time. They were almost nose to nose, and the tent seemed to be getting hotter and hotter until it was like an attic on a late August afternoon just before the cooling thunder showers hit. His head seemed to be swelling and swelling. Her mouth was full of that shit. He couldn't take his eyes off that. The question that ran around and around in his brain like a mechanical rabbit on a dog track rail was, how long was I sleeping with her after she died? Repulsive, man. Repulsive. The paralysis broke and he scrambled out of the tent, scraping both knees when they came off the ground sheet and onto the naked earth. He thought he was going to puke himself, and he struggled with it, willing himself not to. He hated to puke worse than anything. And then he thought, but I was going back in there to fuck her, man. And everything came up in a loose rush, and he crawled away from the steaming mess, crying and hating the cruddy taste in his mouth and nose. He thought about her most of the morning. He felt a measure of relief that she had died. A great measure, actually. He would never tell anyone that. I ain't no nice guy, he said aloud. And having said it, he felt better. It became easier to tell the truth, and truth-telling was the most important thing. He had made an agreement with himself. No, he had made a sacred pact with himself that he was going to take care of her. Maybe he wasn't no nice guy, but he was no murderer either, and what he had done in the tunnel was pretty damn close to attempted murder. So he was going to take care of her. He wasn't going to shout at her no matter how pissed he got sometimes, like when she grabbed him with her patented Kansas City clutch as they mounted the Harley. He wasn't going to get mad no matter how much she held him back or how stupid she could be about some things. The night before last, she had put a can of peas into the coals of their fire without ventilating the top, and he had fished it out all charred and swelled about 3 seconds before it would have gone off like a bomb, maybe blinding them with flying hooks of tin shrapnel. But had he read her out about it? No, he hadn't. He had made a light joke and passed it off. Same with the pills. He had figured the pills were her business. Maybe you should have discussed it with her. Maybe she wanted you to. It wasn't a friggin' encounter session, he said aloud. It was survival, and she hadn't been able to cut it. Maybe she had known it, too. Maybe shit, Larry said angrily. He tipped the canteen up to his mouth, but it was empty, and he still had that slimy taste in his mouth. Maybe there were people like her all over the country. The flu didn't just leave survivor types. Why the hell should it? There might be a young guy somewhere in the country right now, perfect physical condition, immune to the flu, but dying of tonsillitis. Larry was sitting on a paved scenic turnout just off the highway. The view of Vermont marching away to New York in the golden morning haze was breathtaking. A sign announced that this was 12-mile Point. Actually, Larry thought he could see a lot further than 12 miles. On a clear day, you could see forever. So why was he feeling so bad anyway? He was telling the truth, wasn't he? And the worst of the truth was that he felt relief, wasn't it? That the stone around his neck was gone. No, the worst is being alone, being lonely. Corny, but true. He wanted someone to share this view with, someone he could turn to and say with modest wit, on a clear day you can see forever. And the only company was in a tent a mile and a half back with a mouthful of green puke, getting stiff, drawing flies. Larry put his head on his knees and closed his eyes. He told himself he wouldn't cry. He hated to cry almost as bad as he hated to puke. In the end, he was chicken. He couldn't bury her. He summoned up the worst thoughts he could, maggots and beetles, the woodchucks that would smell her and come in for a munch, the unfairness of one human being leaving another like a candy wrapper or a discarded Pepsi can. But there also seemed to be something vaguely illegal about burying her, and to tell the truth, and he was telling the truth now, wasn't he? That was just a cheap rationalization. He could face going down to Bennington and breaking into the ever-popular hardware store, taking the ever-popular spade and a matching ever-popular pick. He could even face coming back up here where it was still and beautiful and digging the ever-popular grave near the ever-popular 12-mile Point. But to go back into that tent, which would now smell very much like the comfort station on Transverse Number 1 in Central Park, where the ever-popular dark sweet treat would be sitting for eternity, and unzip her side of the sleeping bag the rest of the way and pull out her stiff and baggy body and drag it up to the hole by the armpits and tumble it in and then shovel the dirt over it, watching the earth patter on her white legs and stick in her hair. Uh-uh, buddy. Guess I'll sit this one out. If I'm a chicken, so be it. Plucka, plucka, plucka. He went back to where the tent was pitched and turned back the flap. He found a long stick. He took a deep breath of fresh air, held it, and hooked his clothes out with the stick. Backed away with them, put them on. Took another deep breath, held it, and used the stick to fish out his boots. He sat on a fallen tree and put them on, too. The smell was in his clothes. Bullshit, he whispered. He could see her, half in and half out of the sleeping bag, her stiff hand held out and still curled around the pill bottle that was no longer there. Her half-lidded eyes seemed to be staring at him accusingly. Quickly, he used the stick to close the tent flap. But he could still smell her on him. So he made Bennington first stop after all, and in the Bennington men's shop he stripped off all his clothes and got new ones. 3 changes plus 4 pairs of socks and shorts. He even found a new pair of boots. Looking at himself in the 3-way mirror, he could see the empty store spread out behind him and the Harley leaning raffishly at the curb. Sharp threads, he murmured. Heavy, heavy. But there was no one to admire his taste. He left the store and gunned the Harley into life. He supposed he should stop at the hardware store and see if they had a tent and another sleeping bag, but all he wanted now was to get out of Bennington. He would stop further up the line. He looked up toward where the land made its slow rise as he guided the Harley out of town, and he could see 12-mile Point, but not where they had pitched the tent. That was really all for the best. It was... There he looked back at the road, and terror jumped nimbly down his throat. An International Harvester pickup towing a horse trailer had swerved to avoid a car, and the horse trailer had overturned. He was going to drive the Harley right into it because he hadn't been looking where he was going. He turned hard right, his new boot dragging on the road, and he almost got around. But the left footrest clipped the trailer's rear bumper and yanked the bike out from under him. Larry came to rest on the highway's verge with a bone-rattling thump. The Harley chattered on for a moment behind him and then stalled out. "You all right?" he asked aloud. Thank God he'd only been doing 20 or so. Thank God Rita wasn't with him. She'd be bullshit out of her mind with hysterics. Of course, if Rita had been with him, he wouldn't have been looking up there in the first place. He would have been taking care of business so she wouldn't get any more scared than necessary. "I'm all right," he answered himself, but he still wasn't sure he was. He sat up. The quiet impressed itself upon him, as it did from time to time. It was so quiet that if you thought about it, you could go crazy. Even Rita bawling would have been a relief at this point. Everything seemed suddenly full of bright twinkles, and with sudden horror he thought he was going to pass out. He thought, "I really am hurt. In just a minute I'll feel it when the shock wears off. I'm cut bad or something, and who's going to put on a tourniquet?" But when the instant of faintness had passed, he looked at himself and thought he was probably all right. He had cut both hands, and his new pants had shredded away at the right knee. The knee was also cut. But they were just scrapes, and what the fuck was the big deal? Anybody could dump their cycle. It happens to everybody once in a while. But he knew what the big deal was. He could have hit his head the right way and fractured his skull, and he would have lain there in the hot sun until he died. He walked shakily over to the Harley and stood it up. It didn't seem to be damaged in any way, but it looked different. Before, it had been just a machine, a rather charming machine that could serve the dual purpose of transporting him and making him feel like James Dean or Jack Nicholson in Hell's Angels on Wheels. But now its chrome seemed to grin at him like a sideshow barker, seeming to invite him to step right up and see if he was man enough to ride the two-wheeled monster. It started on the third kick, and he putted out of Bennington at no more than walking speed. He was wearing bracelets of cold sweat on his arms, and suddenly he had never, no, never in his whole life, wanted so badly to see another human face.